Good morning, everyone. It's a lovely day outside. It may start raining a little later, but that'll be all right, too. Yeah. Actually, that'd be a good thing, I think. That's getting the summer right. We are at the last class of the period of the divided kingdom. Debbie and I will be disappearing off into the Netherlands for, well, actually, it's Spain, but... for about 3 weeks, Benjamin will be taking the class starting next Sunday, and he'll actually take all four of the Sundays in June. And then on July, Mark and I will be swapping, and Mark will take the Sunday morning class. And he's beginning a study in... Praying for Spiritual Growth as part of our... theme for this year, about midway through the year, starting that up again. So that'll be good. And on Sunday evenings, I'll be taking on Titus, Philemon, and Jude. So we'll be doing some of the short books that we don't get to very often and talking about them. But this morning, we are going to be looking at the very last days of the divided kingdom, that time period when even Judah couldn't seem to get its act together, when the sins of Manasseh were going to catch up with them, and Judah would effectively lose its nationality for all time. They never again came back as a sovereign nation. They were suffered to come back under Cyrus in Persia. They sort of existed as an entity up through the period of the Romans, but never again were they self-reliant. So this is kind of an interesting period. And there's a lot around this period, and we'll talk about that as we go forward. Before we start this morning, I want to ask David Mayfield, if you would, to lead us in a word of prayer. All right. As we look at this tumultuous period in history, especially in Judea's history, one of the ways that you can tell just how much was going on is by looking at the number of gray lines that I've got on the top here. Each of those gray lines is a prophet being active. And a lot of those names should look really familiar when you start looking at Jeremiah and Daniel and Ezekiel. Zephaniah, Nahum, and Habakkuk are three of the minor prophets. They were smaller in stature in their writings, right? That's how they're minor prophets, is they just didn't write as much down. But you have three of the four major prophets that are active during this period. And the other thing to keep in mind is they probably knew each other. If you thought about just this short period, we're only talking about, you know, the final in 586 and Josiah dying here right at probably 607, 609 kind of time frame. Not many years. And when that first round of captives go off in 605, and we'll talk about that in just a minute, under Jehoiakim, and they take Daniel, Jeremiah's probably a teenager. Jeremiah is an older man by that time. Ezekiel is probably a teenager watching them being marched out of the gates. So these people would have known each other. This was a small place in Jerusalem. And in charge, we've got the sons of Josiah. Josiah was a pretty good king. He really tried hard to get things going. And in fact, he was given a boon in his life because he had settled his heart to God. But it seems when you look at it, it was kind of one of those double-sided sort of gifts, right? God said there's going to be punishment coming on this nation. What was the gift that he gave Josiah in that regard? You won't see it. You won't see it. But it was going to come in the days of his children. And that was, it's almost like it was just inevitable at that point. When you start looking at the book of Jeremiah, and we studied that a couple of years ago, and you get to a point where Jeremiah basically proclaims that the captivity is inevitable. It's going to happen. There's nothing that can change that at that point. And he moves from this feeling of getting people to repent so that, God would relent on the nation to simply getting them to surrender to Nebuchadnezzar so that they would survive and save their lives. And he couldn't even get them to go that far. When you start looking at what happened to Josiah, I don't know why it doesn't tell us his motivations, but he tried to interfere with Pharaoh Necho as Necho is heading north to join up with the Assyrians in battle against the Babylonians. Josiah met him in the plains of Megiddo, which on the previous map is right in this area here. So the Pharaoh is coming up along this way. Josiah is coming out of Jerusalem. They meet up here, and that's where he is killed. Now, Pharaoh says, get out of the way. I'm doing what God's telling me to do. You shouldn't be in this battle. And in fact, Josiah was supposed to be kind of a vassal of Egypt at that point and shouldn't have been going to that battle. But he picked that moment to rebel and lost his life. So when he comes back, we find out beginning in 2 Kings, in the 23rd chapter, it says, the rest of the acts of Josiah and all that he did, beginning in verse 28, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? In his days, Pharaoh Necho, king of Egypt, went up to the king of Assyria to the river Euphrates. And King Josiah went to meet him, and when Pharaoh Necho saw him, he killed him at Megiddo. And so that's what we were just talking about. However, his servants drove his body in a chariot from Megiddo and brought him to Jerusalem, buried him in his own tomb. And then the people of the land took Jehoahaz, the son of Josiah, and anointed him and made him king in place of his father. Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he became king, and he reigned 3 months in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his fathers had done. And Pharaoh Necho imprisoned him at Riblah in the land of Hamath that he might not reign in Jerusalem. And he imposed on the land a fine of 100 talents of silver and a talent of gold. So the first king, right after Josiah, lengthy reign. How long? 3 months. Why was it only 3 months? Yeah, so they bring Josiah back, and the people say, okay, take the son of Josiah, make him king. And Pharaoh Necho, coming back through, says, nope, not so much. This guy is now a prisoner, political prisoner. He is going to be hauled off back to Egypt because his father had committed this transgression of rebelling against Egypt. And so he's hauled back, and his brother becomes king for a while. And so it quickly changes over. So Jehoiakim makes this his brother king, Eliakim, in verse 34, the son of Josiah, king in the place of Josiah's father, and changed his name to Jehoiakim. But he took Jehoahaz away and brought him to Egypt, and he died there. So Jehoiakim gave the silver and gold to Pharaoh, but he taxed the land in order to give the money at the command of Pharaoh. He exacted the silver and gold from the people of the land, each according to his valuation, to give it to Pharaoh Necho. Jehoiakim was 25 years old, and he became king. He reigned 11 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zebediah, the daughter of Pedaiah of Ruma, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers had done. So we got the second king now. Now, did you notice the two taglines there when they were comparing how these kings behaved and performed? What did it say? They did evil in the sight of the Lord. Now, one of the things that kind of ought to be one of those questions you ask, you know, Mark and I are good at this, like, why do we ask these questions? 3 months, that seems like a really tough, small period of time to say he's doing evil in the sight of the Lord. You think it was only those 3 months? Why would it say a statement like, he's doing evil in the sight of the Lord? I think it started long before he became king. This is someone who's growing up not doing what's right. You also notice that there's two different mothers here mentioned, even though they're brothers. So apparently Josiah had multiple wives, children by them. There's something lacking here in their upbringing because they're just deciding right there at the front as they become king that things are going to be different. It says they did evil in the sight of the Lord. So part of this is the continued deterioration of the kingdom. He gets 11 years. He's supposed to be a vassal to Egypt. And, of course, as a punishment for his father's evil doings in rebelling against the Pharaoh, what is the land subjected to? More taxes. Remember, there's only a couple of things that kings want. They want taxes, and they want quiet. And so that's the two things that he's trying to make sure go on here, right? In Josiah, he lost the quiet part. So he's making sure that that doesn't happen again. And now he's got the taxes coming in. But that doesn't last long either because, you see, there's a lot of turmoil in this time period. There's this guy here. His name is Nabopolassar. He has been increasing the reign that the Babylonian Empire has been absorbing in the world. And, of course, they're running into the Assyrians because they're kind of in the same neck of the woods up there. And he's been winning a lot. And, in fact, in this battle at Carchemish at 605, which is coming up right during the reign of Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar is the one who winds up winning that battle. So we've got Jehoiakim, which is the one who got carried off. Jehoiakim is the king for 11 years, but only a part of that was under the Egyptian reign. Because look at chapter 24. It says that in his days, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came up, and Jehoiakim became his servant for 3 years. And then he turned and rebelled against him. And the Lord sent against him bands of Chaldeans, bands of Arameans, bands of Moabites, bands of Ammonites. So he sent them against Judah to destroy it, according to the word of the Lord, which he had spoken through his servants, the prophets. Surely at the command of the Lord it came upon Judah to remove them from his sight because of the sins of Manasseh according to all that he had done. And also for the innocent blood which he had shed because he filled Jerusalem with innocent blood and the Lord would not forgive. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoiakim and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? Now when you look at Jehoiakim here, again, doing evil, he only gets a short reign before Nebuchadnezzar comes. But the description there of why all these things are happening. Can you imagine Jehoiakim? He's taking the reign. Things have been relatively smooth in Judah up to this point in terms of outside forces, other than the big guys, right? Okay, am I going to pay taxes to Assyria or am I going to pay taxes to Egypt? That was the big decision that he had, really, is all it amounted to. Whichever one was more powerful at the time, that's the one they had to pay taxes to. Now, all of a sudden, out of left field, the Ammonites start, you know, coming up and coming against him. And then there's the Moabites. Now, these are all people that they've had conflicts for in their past, but which have been pretty quiet. And can you imagine every day he wakes up with a new one on the battlefront and going, guess what? There's another band that they've risen and they're coming against us again. And he's going, what? I'm out of army. I don't have any more army. What am I going to do? Why was all of this happening to him? God said, this is what I have promised you. There's a couple of lessons here. This was the nation of Judah. This was God's chosen people. These were people who he had set aside out of all the world to be his inheritance. And what's happening to the nation? It is falling apart. Why? Why? Somebody's got to know. Yeah. Somebody made some bad choices along the line, didn't they, somewhere along the line? And they just get compounded? You know, even under God's protection, is this thing going to last forever? No, not this one. Not this one. And that was something that people just couldn't get a grip on.
And, you know, he demonstrated that when they were originally taking the land. And God said, even though he promised it, he goes, but not you guys.
Yeah, yeah. So even when they were going, when he was promising it to Abraham, I'll go back even to that far, and he said, okay, I'm going to give it to you, but not yet, because the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet complete. One of the things he was saying there was Judah was going to be a nation of judgment on those others who were currently living there. Now what's happening? Who's the nation of judgment going to be? Yeah, it's going to be Babylon. And we're going to find out if we start looking at the prophets that God says, I've appointed them to do it. These others are just sort of the front-end forces to sort of weaken him up a little bit. You know, beat him down a little bit so Babylon's really not going to have much of a hard time at all taking over this place. So Jehoiakim is subject to this first battle. In 605, there was a huge battle with Nebuchadnezzar against the Assyrians and the Egyptians. The Egyptians are running tail. They are heading south fast as they can go. And Nebuchadnezzar is right on their heels. And this little bit about Nebuchadnezzar appointing them is right at that time, 605. And actually that is mentioned in Jeremiah. Actually, interested in Jeremiah 46, it talks about this battle of Carchemish and the fact that that was what the Lord had appointed for Babylon to begin assuming their position of superiority. And they take the first set of captives. Who's one of the first ones that get hauled off into Babylonian captivity here in 605? Daniel. So when you start looking at what's happening in Babylon at this point, you go to the book of Daniel. And those first few chapters talk about his early years there as he's undergoing his training and whatnot. Because we've talked about this before, but it's worth mentioning again, especially since it's one of my favorite stories, is that Assyria is of the opinion that the way to keep peace in the land is you first beat the people down, you're very cruel, then you deport them all, you take this group, you shove them over there, and you take this group, you shove them over there, and you mix everybody up, and that way the gods are all confused as to who's living there, and they can't rebel against you, and life will be good from a peace standpoint. There was one problem with that. It really messed up the economy big time because the people didn't know how to farm all those other lands. It was an agricultural economy. And so what happened is although that sort of worked a little bit from the peace standpoint, not so much from the taxes standpoint. Assyria started suffering from a drop in their revenues, and they just simply could not sustain the empire that they had built. And so Babylon comes in with a little different idea. The Babylonians say, okay, what we'll do is we'll let the people stay in their land. We'll deport just the really leaders, okay, and then we'll take some of the young kids and we'll train them up to be really good Babylonians, and then we'll send them back into their native lands as the rulers in that land. So that was the plan. So that's why Daniel is probably of not necessarily royal lineage, but in that household of the ruling elite there, is where he would have come from, because that's what they're getting to take back to Babylon to turn into nice Babylonians. And if you're going to do that, what age do you want to get the kids to before you start that training? You want them early. Now, you want them out of diapers because that's just a pain at that point, right? And by the time they're 18, that's too late. They've already lost the front part of their brain and can't make the right kind of decisions anymore. And so the appropriate age is somewhere in probably the 14 to 15 year old range. So that's probably how old Daniel was as he's getting marched out the gates, was 14 to 15 years old. And yet when he gets to Babylon, what's one of the first things he does? As he stands up for his belief in God and says, you know what? I can't do what you're asking me to do. Now, that to me indicates that he had good training, right? Because now he's out from under mom and dad. And he's having to make some tough choices on his own while learning all these things that the Babylonians are wanting to teach him. And how well did he do that? Did he just sit there and go, you know what? I don't like being here. I'm away from home. This is a mess. I'm just going to sit in my room and pout. Yeah, he went to school and he said, I'm going to do better than everybody else. And he did. Had some help. The Lord was on his side. So he got some big help, but still, that's because his heart was right. and he was trying to do what was right. So we have Daniel in this time period moving out. But it says here in verse 6 that Jehoiakim slept with his fathers, and Jehoiakim, his son, became king in his place. And the king of Egypt did not come out of his land again, for the king of Babylon had taken all that belonged to the king of Egypt, from the brook of Egypt to the river of Euphrates. And Jehoiakim was 18 years old when he became king. He reigned 3 months in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Nehushta, the daughter of Elnath of Jerusalem. He did evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that his fathers had done. We have a pattern here. We're looking at the kings past Josiah. Yeah, it's called, they don't learn anything. They don't figure out the lesson yet, right? 3 months, he's still doing evil. Now this one is the son, so this is where you kind of get to get the roadmap. So Jehoahaz is the first one. He's not actually the eldest. The eldest was actually Jehoiakim. So he was the youngest son. So I'm not sure why they made him king unless they figured he was the sacrificial lamb. Anyway, he gets hauled off by Necho. Next son is the oldest. He's Jehoiakim. And he reigns, but then when the first captives are taken in 605, he's kind of out of it. And finally his son begins to reign, Jehoiakim. So last, the grandson of Josiah is now king. And it says that he did evil, but at the time the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, went up to Jerusalem, and the city came under siege. Now, why would the city come under siege just all of a sudden? I mean, so what's this guy done in 3 months? I don't have to care about Babylon, right? I'm a mighty king. Right. Okay, so he's going to rebel against Babylon as well. And unfortunately, Nebuchadnezzar is at a point where he really doesn't take this kindly. And he says, all right, if you're going to rebel, then we're going to haul a bunch of other people away. So here's Jehoiakim. He just gets to be 3 months before the second group of exiles are taken. And who's in that second group of exiles? Ezekiel. So Daniel's in the first group, and Ezekiel's in the second group. Now, Ezekiel doesn't start his prophecy for a while. He gets carried off into Babylon, but if you remember in the first part of the book of Ezekiel, what was Ezekiel's goal in life? What did he really want to be? Now, remember, he's growing up in Jerusalem in these turbulent times. He's watched Daniel be marched off, one of the ones who is in the royal family. But you see, he's in the priesthood. And his whole point, plan in life was to become a priest. And so he is really bummed out by the river Kibar when he's there going, my whole life is just ruined. Nothing I wanted to do is coming out. The temple's back there. I'm in Babylon. I'm just really bummed out. And God says, I got a job for you. I love Ezekiel because he doesn't argue a whole lot other than when God picks him up and sets him down in the midst of the people. He sits there quiet for 7 days. And I think he's sitting like this. Until God says, let me explain something to you. You have been chosen as a watchman. And there's a job that you have to do. Your job is to talk to the people here in Babylon. And if you tell them what I tell you to tell them, then your neck is out of the noose. You're off the hook. If you don't tell them, then you are responsible. That's a watchman. So we get that lesson from Ezekiel, who was in very similar circumstances to Daniel in terms of his deportation. Little different attitude, but comes around to be one of the ones who has to work with the people there in exile. There's a big rift during this period. One of the things you have to understand is that when you read through Jeremiah, we don't have time for all of it, you get into this, what is happening here? The nation should have come back together. God has always helped us in the past when we've gotten down. And in fact, some of the prophets that are in Jerusalem are coming up and telling the kings, in 2 years, God will restore everything and the temple will be back and everything is going to be just fine. Unfortunately, there's this guy named Jeremiah who's hanging around, who says, I wish that was exactly going to be the way it is. But folks, it's not. And he writes a letter to the ones in captivity. And in that letter is a very interesting phrase. He says, build houses and live in them. Now, building a house then was a little different than building a house now. Mostly a lot of manual labor. Everybody's pitching in, doing it. Something's going to be there for a while, right? If everything's going to be all right in 2 years, would you build houses and plan on living in them? No. He says you're going to be there for at least 70 years. Just settle in, folks. It's going to be 70 years. So even the people that are off in Babylon are having their hopes torn apart. The people in Jerusalem are under siege. Nebuchadnezzar has been coming. This is the second time that he's come against them. Now we've got this little king being hauled off into Babylon. And Nebuchadnezzar is not happy. Nebuchadnezzar, as a king, second priority, wants peace and quiet. So he came to the city while his servants were besieging it. And Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, he and his mother and his servants and his captains and his officials. And so the king of Babylon took him captive in the 8th year of his reign. And he carried out from there all the treasure of the house of the Lord and the treasure of the king's house, and cut in pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon, the king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord, just as the Lord had said. And then he led away into exile all Jerusalem and all the captains and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives, and all the craftsmen and all the smiths. None remained except the poorest people of the land. And so he led Jehoiakim away into exile to Babylon, also the king's mother and the king's wives and his officials and the leading men of the land. He led away into exile all the men of valor, 7,000, and the craftsmen and the smiths, and it repeats all of that, all of those who were fit for war. Actually, that's leading in war. And then the king of Babylon made his uncle, Mattaniah, king in his place, and he changed his name to Zedekiah. Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord according to all that Jehoiakim had done. For through the anger of the Lord, this came about in Jerusalem and Judah until he cast them out from his presence. And Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. I think there was just some genetic defect in these brothers that affected their ego to a point where they just felt like it didn't matter what my other brother had done. Somewhere along the line, I'm going to be the one to make things really right again here in Jerusalem. So they rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar as well. So we got all of these folks down here. Zedekiah is now the uncle. So let's see, what is Zedekiah? It says he did evil. Well, I want to read a short story. Let's go over to Jeremiah 36. Turn over to Jeremiah 36. And we're just going to get an idea of what Zedekiah is like. Beginning in verse 20, the prefix to this is Jeremiah has been trying to get him to make some changes. He's written a bunch of things down on this scroll. And Uriah, another prophet there, and his Baruch, his scribe, they're all together trying to get the king's attention. So in verse 20 it says, they went to the king, and this is Zedekiah, in the court, but they had deposited the scroll in the chamber of Elisha the scribe and reported all the words to the king. And then the king sent Jehudi to get the scroll, and he took it out of the chamber of Elisha the scribe. And Jehudi read it to the king as well as to all of the officials who stood beside the king. Now the king was sitting in the winter house in the 9th month with a fire burning in the brazier before him. And when Jehudi had read 3 or 4 columns, the king cut it with a scribe's knife and threw it into the fire that was in the brazier until all the scroll was consumed in the fire that was in the brazier. Yet the king and all his servants who heard all these words were not afraid, nor did they rend their garments. So, how much respect did he have for God's word? He's got a scroll written by one of the prophets of God, which, if found today, would bring zillions of dollars in a museum, right? And he takes a pen knife. This is a scribe's knife. This would have been just a little sharp thing for cutting vellum, things like that. Your letter opener kind of knife, right? And cuts it up and starts warming his hands over the fire is effectively the picture that you get. Absolute contempt for God's word. Now, that's what was needed in this place at this time. Did God make him that way? No, God just understands that the conditions are going to be there and that this is what's going to be fulfilled. So Zedekiah rebels. He's rebelling against the king of Babylon. He's rebelling against the word of God. And then things just continue to get worse. In the next few chapters here, and then there's plenty of other details in other places, beginning in chapter 24, let's see. No, we read that. Where were we? Okay. I already turned the page. Zedekiah is king, beginning of chapter 25. Now, in the ninth year of his reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came, he and all his army, against Jerusalem. And they camped against it and built a siege wall around it. So the city was under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. And on the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine was so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. Then the city was broken into, and all the men of war fled by way of the gate between the two walls beside the king's garden, though the Chaldeans were all around the city, and they went by way of the Arabah. So here's this really, you know, gung-ho king who's rebelling, and when things get really tough, what's he do? Runs like a chicken, right? He's finding a way out of here. And so by the Arabah, they're going down into the valley. They're going by the barren places where it's less likely the people are going to be. They're trying to slither off into the night. But they captured the king and brought him to the king of Babylon at Riblah, and he passed sentence on him. And they slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and they put out the eyes of Zedekiah and bound him with bronze fetters and brought him to Babylon. Now on the 7th day of the 5th month, which was the 19th year of the king Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, a servant of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem. And he burned the house of the Lord, the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem, even every great house, he burned with fire. So all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captain of the guard broke down the walls around Jerusalem. And the rest of the people who were left in the city, and the deserters who deserted the king of Babylon, and the rest of the people, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away into exile. But the captain of the guard left some of the poorest of the land to be vine dressers and plowmen. It's a very short description there, and there are a few other descriptions over in Chronicles, and especially in Jeremiah. He talks about some of the events that happened during this time period. But it's several months long. Stretches out to where they can no longer support themselves. Hezekiah had dug a tunnel so that they would get water in them and be able to have water there in the city. But even that's beginning to fail. There's no food left. And Nebuchadnezzar's tired of it. And this is going to be an example. And so when he marches in and his armies come into the city, normally if you're going to keep a place active, you don't just tear it down to the ground. So in all of his other assaults against the city, they breached the walls, breached the defenses, marched in and taken people. Oh, I'm sure there was a little burning and looting here and there. You know, armies are kind of like that when they're going into a place. But in the main, they left the government center intact. And although they would have pillaged the temple in each case, it was left intact because it was the center of their worship. But this time is different. This time, he's tired of these little teeny kings and their rebellious ways and having to divert his armies down there when he's got other places he wants his armies to be. And so when his captain of the guard moves in, Nebuzaradan, he tells his troops, just take it down. They're good at that. It talks about the temple and it says there was not one stone left on the other. Now, somewhere back in the early 20s, somebody wrote a book and said, well, the reason was is because there was still a lot of gold in the temple and the gold all melted in the fire and ran down between the stones. And they made up some story about tearing the stones apart. There's nothing that anybody's found in history that actually validates that story. But they did tear all the stones apart. And they did, it say, take everything out. It talks about them in the past, they've taken the easy things. The gold, the silver, precious metals, and that kind of stuff. This time, They're even going to take it further. You might remember what's out front of the temple? Right at the front door. Two huge bronze pillars. Now, we're in this out of the Bronze Age. Bronze isn't as valuable as gold, which is why most of them would have just kind of left it there. But it's got some value, and we're tearing down the temple anyway. So what do you do with these bronze pillars? They had to break them up to even haul them off. They were too big. So they destroyed them in order to haul off the metal. And you remember what was out in the courtyard that Solomon had built? This giant laver. Huge swimming pool size font where the cleansing rituals were conducted. And it was sitting on 12 oxen that represented the 12 tribes of Israel. And what's all that made out of? Bronze. So there's some more stuff to tear up and tear down and carry away. And the king's house. You want to know why it all burned? Remember what it says? He built the king's house. What was one of the things they were very proud of that they'd used to build the king's house? The cedars of Lebanon, right? Cedar is very aromatic. It's a beautiful wood. It also burns really well because it's got a lot of resin and stuff in it. And so they set all that on fire. All this beautiful, expensive lumber going to waste as it's being burned up. And so the king's houses are on fire, and the temple's on fire, and every house in that area of the capital district is on fire. And the soldiers are hauling away everything of value that they can get their hands on. And they're rounding up anybody who is anybody. You know how to work with bronze? Good. We're hauling a lot of bronze back to Babylon. You're coming with us. Oh, you know how to work with metal? We got soldiers in the field who need some blacksmiths. You're coming with us. Oh, you know how to do math? Yeah. Babylon's got a big center where we need some people who know how to do that. So you're coming with us. Anybody who was in the educated or trade got hauled off into captivity. And now, do you think that they got a, you know, one of these nice comfy tour buses together and said, come on, you know, up on the tour bus and we'll give you a nice trip to Babylon? How do you think most of them got there? They walked. They walked. Many times in shackles. And that's how they walked to Babylon. Now, you stay looking at that picture and you're saying, is that how you would have expected the nation of God to end up? So you got to come back and you got to say, why and how? How did it get there? Well, it told us. There's all the sins of Manasseh, the consequences of the evil that had been going on for years and generations caught up with them. Even when the people could repent, it didn't mean that there wouldn't be consequences for the actions of their forebears. There was no remedy. So when you start looking at this, and again, I would encourage you to read over the in Chronicles the same thing there. After they haul the people off, Jeremiah, if you read in his book, he talks about the fact that he had a special dispensation almost. He'd been telling the people to surrender. And apparently the word of that had gotten back to Nebuchadnezzar and to the captains of the guards. And so when they discovered Jeremiah and the captives being hauled off, they went, whoa, wait. This guy actually knew what the right thing to do was. Just turn him loose. He's okay. He can stay here. We won't make this older man walk to Babylon. By that time, Jeremiah is getting a little up in age. And so he tries to help the people that are left, and they appoint this governor, Gedaliah. And Gedaliah says, folks, we can survive. We'll be all right. We just got to do whatever Nebuchadnezzar tells us. Be good little Babylonians. And let's not, you know, get too uppity here. And unfortunately, there were still some precursors to the zealots around who decided that they didn't like that. And so they killed him. And now all of a sudden they realized, oops, this isn't going well. Let's ask Jeremiah what we should do. And of course, Jeremiah, is probably the one prophet that if you want to pick a life in the Bible that you would never want to emulate or have it fall upon you, it's Jeremiah, because he had an entire history of people saying, please tell us what to do. And he would tell them, and then they'd go, nah, I don't think so. And so they came and they asked Jeremiah, what should we do? And they said, if I told you, you just wouldn't do it. No, no, really, please, you got to tell us. We need advice. No, 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 I can't tell you. I said, yes, please. He goes, oh, all right. We'll just stay here. We'll be fine. No, that's not what we're going to do. So they grabbed Jeremiah and they all head down to Egypt. And so it wound up setting up a Jewish community in Egypt. And it's interesting because that was the beginning of a fairly large Jewish community that grew and lived there, but departed radically from the teachings that God had left them. Set up their own little temple, their own little worship, all kinds of other things that they've been finding and some of the archaeology of that area, all dating to that point when Jeremiah and his crew were hauled down into Egypt. So things get bad, and the nation is destroyed. But was that the end of the story? It's not the end of the story. Now, it is in one way, because Jeremiah, in we got just a minute, so I want to read one other passage. If you look over in Jeremiah, the 22nd chapter, during one of his prophecies concerning the kings there, he has a little bit to say about Jehoiakim, because Jehoiakim is sort of the last of the line there. Beginning at verse 24, well, if we had time, read up about Jehoiakim in verses 18 to 23 at some time. Interesting lament there where he says he's going to be buried with a donkey's burial and dragged off and thrown out of the gates of Jerusalem. So understand what's going to happen to him. But he says, as I live, declares the Lord, even though Coniah, the son of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, were a signet ring on my right hand, yet I would pull you off, and I will give you over into the hand of those who are seeking your life, yes, into the hand of those whom you dread, even to the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and into the hand of the Chaldeans. And I will hurl you and your mother who bore you into another country where you were not born, and there you will die. But as for the land which they desire to return, they will not return to it. Is this man Coniah a despised and shattered jar? Or is he an undesirable vessel? Why have he and his descendants been hurled out and cast into a land that they have not known? O land, 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 hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, write this man down childless, a man who will not prosper in his days, for no man of his descendants will prosper sitting on the throne of David or ruling again in Judah. So there was the end of the Davidic line in terms of being kings in Judah. Did Jeconiah, did he have any children? He did. So when he says, write this man down childless, it's not talking there, it's a metaphorical thing. Childless, as we talked about the other night on a Wednesday night, meant that he had not fulfilled responsibility. He was barren, he was waste, he was no good anymore. And none of his children would sit on the throne. One of his children wound up leading them back from Persia when Cyrus said they could go back. But he wasn't king. He was just a governor. And by the time you get down to Joseph, who was in line of David, what's Joseph's occupation? He's a carpenter. And there you go from the heights of living in the palace to eking out a living as a carpenter was what happened to the Davidic line. It's a lesson for everyone when you start looking at the genealogies won't help you. Your ancestors won't help you. There's only one thing that can help you, and that is listening to God and doing what he says. Okay, we're out of time. Thank you. Hopefully it's been a lessons learned class. Thank you.